We've all heard someone say, yeah, she's pretty good for a girl. I'm Jim Meadows, and according to Murphy Henry, that phrase comes up a lot when it comes to bluegrass. Today on Focus, we'll listen back to a conversation Chris Berube had with Murphy about her book, Pretty Good for a Girl, Women in Bluegrass. We'll hear about why so many female musicians have slipped under the radar in that genre, and we'll hear about Murphy's love of the banjo and the Murphy Method, her banjo technique that she now teaches to others. Chris also talks with Murphy Henry about Champaign-Urbana native Alison Krauss and her contributions to bluegrass music. Our program begins after the news. Well, she's pretty good for a girl. We hear that phrase all the time, but according to Murphy Henry, that doesn't make it any less irritating. I'm Jim Meadows, and today on Focus, we're listening back to a conversation Chris Berube had with Murphy Henry about her book, Pretty Good for a Girl, Women in Bluegrass. We begin this hour on Focus by listening to a clip from the book's trailer.
Was the first Scruggs-style banjo tune ever recorded by a woman. It's called Lonesome Road Blues, and it was recorded on an album way back in 1957 by a woman named Ronnie Stoneman.
That's Murphy Henry, who is the author of the new book, Pretty Good for a Girl, which looks at the pioneering women who picked up a banjo or a fiddle or an accordion and were often overlooked because they weren't men. Murphy Henry is a banjo teacher and a musician herself. She's changed many lives with her banjo camps and instructional videos. Her book is out this month, and she joins us on the phone from Virginia. Good morning, Murphy.
Good morning, Chris.
So how are you?
I'm doing just fine. How about yourself?
I'm doing really well, thanks.
Great.
So you started playing banjo at a young age. What inspired you to pick up a banjo?
Well, actually, Chris, I don't really consider having started at a young age because I didn't pick up the banjo till I was in college.
That's young comparatively to some people who play the banjo.
Well, okay. But, you know, I wasn't a banjo prodigy. But I did start on the stringed instruments when I was, like, in the fourth grade with a ukulele and then the guitar. And I picked up the banjo specifically because I went to a bluegrass festival for the first time and noticed that the banjo was the loudest instrument on stage and it got the most attention. And that's what I wanted.
So this was kind of you playing out your own want to be kind of the center of attention a little bit.
Always.
So the story of you coming to this book is an interesting one. It comes from an incident that happened at the International Bluegrass Music Awards that kind of seems like a turning point. You write about it in your book. Could you tell me that story?
Yes. I've forgotten exactly the year, but my daughter, Casey, who was a teenager at the time, and I were sitting in the audience watching the show, and I've always enjoyed the IBMA shows very much, quality productions. This year, they were focusing on youth in bluegrass, and so they had an act on stage called the Bluegrass Youth All-Stars, and it was five young men who, let me tell you this, they are brilliant players. But the announcer, off the cuff, wasn't written into the show, off the cuff, made an introducing them, said, this is the future of bluegrass music, and I just went ballistic in my mind. I'm going like, this can't be the future of bluegrass music. There are no women up there. And, you know, this was definitely in the 90s. My daughter was sitting beside me. This was not about me wanting her on stage, although she was a really good bass player. This is about me wanting any women on stage. And so when I asked the producers about that, they said they'd tried to find a woman, but they couldn't find one. And I thought to myself, well, you didn't call me. You didn't call any of the other women of my age. I will start a database of women in bluegrass so this never can happen again. The database led to a quarterly newsletter called Women in Bluegrass, and the quarterly newsletter led to this book.
So one of the challenges, I guess, for getting women into bluegrass has got to be the issue that, you know, we want role models and we want people who are kind of like us to be our role models in a way. Do you feel like that has been a barrier for women getting into bluegrass, that they just don't have a lot of people they look up to necessarily?
I certainly do think that that's part of it, you know, that in when I was taking up the banjo, I just wasn't aware that there were any other women out there playing the banjo. I mean, clearly there was Ronnie Stoneman, People may recognize her name as the banjo player from the old show Hee Haw. But, you know, I wasn't aware of her. So there is that. But, Chris, there's also the other thing that if a woman, a young woman wants to, you know, get outside the box, outside the boundaries, at least back when I was learning to play the banjo, other women have had this experience. You are told that you can't do it, that you're not strong enough, that you're not talented enough, that you're not something enough, you're not good enough. You know, that's really discouraging.
Yeah, you have a quotation in the book from someone saying that, you know, women, this is a fairly prominent person, Bluegrass, saying women lack the inherent ability to play. And this is, you know, a very arcane quote. This is what somebody said a long time ago, but
right.
That's, I can't imagine that attitude completely goes away when someone believes that even like 50 years ago.
No, it doesn't go away. And I think it's that particular attitude is a little bit more prevalent for women who want to play lead acoustic guitar or the mandolin. Which, you know, I'm a banjo player. I play a little guitar. I play a little mandolin. You know, people have always thought that women, honest to Pete, didn't have the strength in their hands to play the mandolin or guitar. I mean, it's just patently untrue. But there you go.
So I guess that's where the term pick like a girl comes from. Because I was surprised, like, yeah, people say pick like a girl. I was wondering, what does that even mean? It just means they don't have, like, the finger strength to play the banjo?
You sound like maybe, Chris, that, I mean, you sound like a very young person. I grew up in the 50s. Everything that was, when you wanted to denigrate somebody, you always said they did it like a girl. Baseball, you know, you bat like a girl. A baseball, you throw like a girl. All the jokes about women drivers, oh, there was an accident, must have been a woman driver. It was just, you know, throughout the whole culture of that time. And I feel certain that women in other genres of music and other walks of life have heard that same thing. It's just a way of cutting somebody down.
Now, you got into bluegrass music when you did. Do you feel like you had to put on kind of a masculine front at all to break into bluegrass music as a woman?
Whether I actually really had to or not, I did. I mean, that's what I did. I became one of the boys as much as I could. I was always a tomboy, though, so that felt like an easy role to slip into. You know, I really admire women like my friend Lynn Morris, who's a banjo player, who always chose purposely to wear a dress on stage to show that she really was a woman. I wanted to look as much like a boy as possible.
It's funny, when I was doing research for this, I saw that you had a song called I Ain't Domesticated Yet. And unfortunately, I couldn't find it. I don't know if it's still in print, but that seems like you'd come a long way by that point, that you were making, you know, these songs with explicitly feminist messages in the mode of bluegrass.
Oh, absolutely. And part of that, I was really writing against the great body of bluegrass songs that were out there, which just weren't appropriate or easy for a woman to sing. I mean, I guess one of my favorite is a number called Good Woman's Love. I mean, that's not something I sing could feel comfortable on stage singing, or I don't know, Rolling My Sweet Baby's Arms, maybe, yes. But just that Cabin Homes on the Hill, I had no relation to that. So I tried to write about things that, you know, I could really speak from experience. Bill Monroe called those bluegrass true songs.
Why would he call those bluegrass true songs?
That's the songs that he wrote of his own life experience. He was always writing about, women problems, and his girlfriend had just left him, or his own angst at leaving his home in Kentucky. I'm on my way back to the old home. He wrote from his own experience, and he called those true songs, I guess, as opposed to songs that were written by people that weren't about their own personal experience.
We're speaking with Murphy Henry. Her new book is called Pretty Good for a Girl, Women in Bluegrass. And if you're a musician, if you're a female musician who's had experiences like the ones that we're talking about, or you just want to chat about the book with Murphy, give us a call at 217-333-9455, or you can find us online. We're on Twitter at Focus580. So, Murphy, when you started writing this book, I mean, what did you think the project of the book was?
You mean, what did I think the book was going to be about?
Yeah, what were you trying to accomplish with the book?
Boy, you know, it took me 10 years to write this, Chris. So I think I sort of jumped in, as I often do, without any really clear focus other than I wanted to share the life stories of women whose stories had not been told. For instance, Sally Ann Forrester is the first woman I wrote about, and I actually did my master's thesis on Sally Ann. She played accordion with Bill Monroe in the 1940s, and she recorded with Bill Monroe, and she sang tenor to Bill Monroe, first person to ever sing tenor to Bill Monroe on record. Well, nobody knew very much about Sally Ann, and because she played the accordion, which is nowadays a non-standard bluegrass instrument, they just totally blew her off. I mean, she didn't count in any way, shape, or form. And I just thought, that's wrong, that's bad, that's unfortunate. And so I was able to get hold of her son, Bob Forrester, and get a lot of first-person sources and tell her story really from the ground up and discover that she was, before she joined Monroe, she had a flourishing musical career on her own. I mean, she was important. And that sort of, I guess, maybe set the tone for the rest of the book, to tell these stories of women who people have never had heard of, or they'd heard of them and they had just assumed that they were of little importance.
Now, for those who aren't too familiar with bluegrass, I mean, the significance of her playing with Bill Monroe is that a lot of people consider Bill Monroe kind of the start of bluegrass as a genre.
Many people do consider that, yes.
And I actually want to play a track from that period of Bill Monroe.
Great.
So let's hear a little bit of Footprints in the Snow from 1945.
Like the summertime, and they can walk about, strolling through the meadow green, it's cutting their low down. But maybe the wintertime, when the snow is on the ground, for a founder when the snow is on the ground. Oh, I traced a little footprints in the snow. I found a little footprints in the snow. Oh, I blessed a happy day.
That's Bill Monroe and his Bluegrass Boys with Footprints in the Snow. And if you listen, I can definitely hear a little bit of the accordion on that track.
Yes, yes. I was listening really hard. You can just hear it. It's really in the background on that particular cut. But there were one or two cuts from that same time period, recording the same time, where Sally Ann actually takes a solo lead on the accordion.
It's so interesting. I mean, in the book you mentioned that some people were just so unfamiliar with the idea of women getting into bluegrass, they assumed that a rumor went around, I guess, that she was kind of a package deal with her husband, who was a fiddle player, that they thought, oh, yeah, well, the reason that she's playing with them is because her husband was insisting, like, yeah, she has to be here if I'm going to be here.
Exactly. And then when her husband, Howdy Forrester, who was a fabulous fiddle player, left to go into World War II, Sally Ann stayed on with Bill Monroe through the duration of the war, and then the rumor became, oh, she was only in the band to hold Howdy's place. So when he came back, you know, he would have a place in the band. I mean, that's just, when you look at it and think about it, why would Bill Monroe have somebody in his band who couldn't pull their own weight as a musician? That's just extra baggage. That's just so untrue.
Yeah, it seems like, going back to this role model question of not having visible role models in bluegrass for a lot of women, it kind of seems like part of the reason for that is because, you know, somebody like Sally Ann Forrester might get elected because she really played the supporting role, because she was really in kind of the background of a lot of these recordings.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, that is true. But on the other hand, you know, Chris, even in the 50s, when Ronnie Stoneman, I mentioned her when I was in your intro, when she was playing the banjo with the Stoneman family, and when her sister Donna was playing the mandolin with the Stoneman family, I mean, their playing was also blown off in a different way because they were women. They wore, sometimes in the 60s, they wore short skirts and go-go boots. You remember the white go-go boots? And they danced around on stage. So people blew off their music. It just happens for a number of different reasons.
Now, did you get to meet Sally Ann while you were reporting out this book?
Unfortunately, by the time I decided to do my master's thesis on Sally Ann, she was in the very, very late stages of Alzheimer's disease in Nashville. And her son, Bob, did take me in to see her, and she was just lying in the bed, not able to communicate. But I did get to know her son, Bob, very well, and her brother-in-law, Joe Forrester, who played bass with Bill Monroe in the same band that Sally Ann played in. So I got a lot of sort of secondhand, first-person information, you know, from Joe about Sally Ann. I really regret that I didn't get onto this sooner.
So what happened to her after she was with Bill Monroe?
Oh, that's a good question. She left Bill Monroe in the spring of 1946. She and her husband, Howdy, who had returned from the war to play fiddle. And they went on to perform not really bluegrass music, but more of a fiddle-based western swing music, eventually ending up in Texas, playing with a fiddle player called Georgia Slim Rutland, doing like a nightclub act. And she played the accordion there. But eventually they, as a team, quit the music business and came back to Nashville, where she took a job in the Social Security Administration. And her husband, Howdy, went on to play fiddle with Roy Acuff for several decades. So she dropped out of the music business, as many men do. You play for a little while, then you go get a good day job.
It seems like, I mean, with a lot of these women from the 40s and 50s especially, I mean, there wasn't a lot of documents that you could look at. You had to do a lot of primary research to find out about these people. And it seems like with a lot of these people, yeah, they had to drop out of music, and probably they don't really have a sense of their own place in bluegrass history. Like, they probably think that they're kind of footnotes.
That's a really good observation. That would have been a good question to pose to any of the women that I had interviewed personally. But I think you're right. I don't think Sally Ann, gathering from just being around her son Bob, I don't think she thought she was a big deal, in the music world, or even thought she'd been passed up because she didn't realize that she was important. I think that's a very good observation.
You're listening to Focus on WILL, and we're going to turn to the phone lines. We have Tom from Prairieton, Indiana, calling in. And Tom, I know you have a comment for us.
I'm enjoying your show a lot. You know, I love bluegrass. I used to be a bluegrass promoter when I was in college back in the 70s. So, believe me, I get it. Now, I'm wondering if your guest is not being a bit shrill. Bluegrass musicians love music, and they don't really give a damn the sex of the musician because they think whoever's a good player is a good player. They don't care. And I'm wondering if she's not just making a bit more of it than really was, because I've heard a lot of great female musicians, a lot, and nobody said a damn thing about she's good for a woman. No, for what she was, and true musicians really appreciate other musicians. I hope you understand where I'm coming from.
Well, thank you for calling in, Tom. So Tom's a musician who is saying, Murphy, that in his experience he felt that bluegrass is very democratic, that he didn't have those kind of experiences in terms of, you know, there being sexism towards women. So what do you make of that?
I mean, I think I understand. I do understand where Tom is coming from. And I think that good musicians do appreciate the level of musicianship, you know, no matter what the gender is. I think, you know, from my own experience and the experience of women that I talk to, that I don't know what you would call it, the difficulty or the prejudice is so underground that you just don't really, it's not overt. Like, somebody's not going to say, I'm not going to play with you because you're a girl. It's just that, you know, one of the women I wrote about, Lee Linker, who's on the cover of the book, said her experience was just in jam sessions, she would just get squeezed out of the circle. You know, you're standing around jamming, and the circle just tightens up, and pretty soon she's on the outside of it. Other women have spoken about that experience. It's sort of a tough thing, you know, to quantify, but I did try to explain that or talk about it in depth in the book.
Now, you mentioned it's interesting. You mentioned Leanne Linker is on the cover,
mm-hmm.
and that actually is a photo in the book of her, and she's surrounded by a bunch of musicians, and they're all men.
Right.
I mean, do you feel like women started becoming more prominent in bluegrass because they played in bands with men, or you also mentioned there were all of these all-female bluegrass bands that kind of put some people on the map in the 70s?
You know, a lot of women, as I say in the book, that the 70s, the floodgates opened, and more women were playing in bands. They were taking on more roles of lead instruments. And part of that, Chris, I just think was the time was right, you know, shall we say. There had been a lot of groundwork laid, you know, by the women's movement, you know, up until that time, and a lot of doors were opening for women in many professions, and bluegrass was one of them. The all-female bands were really a way for women to get stage time and professional experience when they couldn't be hired by the all-male bands. You know, that gave them a chance to play the lead instruments and go out on the road in companionship with other women, when they didn't have an entry point like a father, son, brother, cousin who played in a band.
I feel like also, you know, speaking to Tom's point, Tom who called in to say that, you know, it seems like it's more equitable and it seems like musicians are more accepting of women. Is it maybe a thing with audiences? Do you feel like audiences maybe receive female bluegrass musicians differently than other musicians might?
You know, that's a good question also, Chris. And I think I had this realization when I was writing the book that, in fact, I don't believe it is the audiences. I believe the audiences are, in fact, receptive, as Tom said, to good musicianship. And they're receptive to somebody that puts on a good show. So when I was writing the book, I mean, people, for instance, like Ginger Boatwright, she was an early woman in bluegrass who did not have a classical, a hard-edged bluegrass voice. She didn't have a mountain voice. She was a little softer singer. Well, she had a wonderful career carved out with a band called Red, White, and Bluegrass. They obviously had an audience. They played college shows. They made albums. Audiences loved them. But places where albums were reviewed were the places that they were talking about her voice not being bluegrass. I mean, that's some of where the problem was with reviewers or pundits, you know, listening to music and commenting on it and say, oh, she doesn't sing bluegrass, she doesn't have a bluegrass voice. The audiences, I don't think, cared.
I'm Jim Meadows, and you're listening to an encore edition of Focus. Today on the show, we're listening back to a conversation Chris Berube had with Murphy Henry earlier this summer about her book, Pretty Good for a Girl, Women in Bluegrass. In addition to being an author, Murphy is a musician herself. We're about to take a short break, but first, we're going to hear the song Just Because from her album M&M Blues. We'll be right back. This is Focus. Stay with us. Welcome back to Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. You're listening to an encore edition and a conversation Chris Berube had with Murphy Henry, bluegrass musician, banjo teacher, and author of the book Pretty Good for a Girl, Women in Bluegrass.
So, Murphy, I want to talk a bit about somebody who's local to here in Champaign-Urbana, who's made an impact in bluegrass music, which is Alison Krauss.
Oh, absolutely. Alison Krauss, fabulous musician, wonderful person, funny, and she has become what we were talking about earlier, the role model for a whole next generation of young women who have something they can aspire to, which is to be a great fiddle player, to be a great band leader, and to actually make a living playing bluegrass music.
So Alison Krauss was born in the 70s, and who were kind of her role models? Like, how did she get into bluegrass?
A specific role model that Alison has mentioned is Rhonda Vincent. Alison said about seeing Rhonda that she was so powerful, you know, as a performer, yet so feminine at the same time. And Allison found that combination just, you know, very intriguing. But you know, Allison got her start. Her parents wanted her to do something musical, and so Allison chose the fiddle, which she started playing when she was about 5 years old. And she was classically trained, and she, you know, enjoyed that until she got close to being a teenager, and then she found that the, you know, classical music, you read music and you play classical tunes in a preordained style. There's not any room for improvisation. She found that a little too confining, and you can imagine with her great talent that would have been confining. And so then she got into fiddle contests and won a number of those and studied some of the great bluegrass fiddle players like Randy Howard and Stuart Duncan. And then she discovered bluegrass music by finding albums of, she said, Tony Rice has been a huge influence, and J.D. Crowe and Ricky Skaggs. And she just devoured those albums, and she just fell in love with bluegrass and the whole music, and played in a couple of bands that were local, Illinois and Indiana, and then signed with Rounder Records when she was just 14 years old, and then sort of the rest is history. She took off from there.
Yeah, it's incredible. I mean, reading your book, she sounds like, Allison Krauss sounds like this incredible autodidact. Like, she signed to Rounder when she was 14. She already basically had kind of a voice as a musician sort of in place at that point, and like, she skipped the last 2 years of high school. Like, it's just kind of remarkable how much she got accomplished at a young age.
Yes, absolutely. So, and you know, one of the things I put in the book about Allison, you know, even though she'd done the fiddle since she was five and done classical and gone into contest style fiddling and was very supported by her parents, and she'd played in some local bands, but you know, there were a lot of other musicians who were young and sort of on that same track. And she just, you know, she had the voice, and she got the break that the group she was playing in, Classified Grass, just sent an unsolicited cassette to Ken Irwin at Rounder Records. And my understanding of it, that Ken was listening to this cassette in the company of Hazel Dickens, who's another woman in the book. And Hazel was somewhat, you know, influential with Ken, going like, hey, her fiddle playing's good, but listen to her voice. Listen to that voice. And so in that way, Hazel had an influence on, you know, on Ken and Allison being signed to Rounder Records.
Reading, like, the early reviews of Allison Krauss, a lot of them say, you know, she has a very pretty voice, she has a beautiful voice, but that it was a little bit thin. I mean, why do you think that criticism came up?
Well, I mean, my reading of it, Chris, and I was just reviewing this chapter before we did this interview, that and I remember listening to her first albums where Allison was actually singing had a big voice, where she sang like some of her other heroes and heroines, like Rhonda has a big full voice and John Cowan has a big full voice. People then were saying that she was a little shrill. It was too much. And then, you know, along about her third or fourth album, she sort of pulled back her style and got this carefully controlled, immaculate, more of a softer voice. And so to answer your question, I think people in bluegrass, again, thought that it wasn't bluegrassy enough, you know, because it's the role model thing again. Who in the magazine were people most used to listening to? Bill Monroe, Jimmy Martin, the Stanley Brothers, Jim and Jesse. And a lot of women hadn't made it into print. Their albums weren't getting much publicity. So Ginger Boatwright, you know, came before Allison. She had a softer voice. Martha Adcock, Wendy Thatcher, people weren't familiar with their voices. So Allison's voice sounded so different.
Well, we've been talking a lot about Allison's voice. Let's actually hear a little bit of it. And this particular cut is from the O Brother, Where Art Thou soundtrack, which was such a big hit a couple of years ago. This is her and Gillian Welch doing the song I'll Fly Away. So this is Allison Krauss on WILL.
Fly away to
Alison Krauss and Gillian Welch off of the Oh Brother, Where Art Thou soundtrack, doing I'll Fly Away. And it's interesting. You say in the book, Alison Krauss maybe does not have a lot of, like a lot of people did not consider her bluegrassy enough. And you say that when she was growing up, she was listening to, you know, all these people like Huey Lewis in the News and Stevie Wonder, that she was particularly not dedicated to one genre necessarily, that she had pretty broad taste. I mean, do you feel like it matters that she's bluegrassy enough or not? I mean, she's managed to become so successful in part because she brings in all of these other influences outside of bluegrass.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I don't think it matters that she's, and I would put that in, you know, the air quotes, bluegrassy or not. She's just a stellar talent, you know, who's decided to, you know, do part of her music as bluegrass. But Alison herself has said, you know, when she does things that are so completely outside the bluegrass genre, she said, you know, I don't pretend like those are bluegrass. You know, I do some music sort of to satisfy this part of my soul, and I do bluegrass to satisfy this other part of my soul, but I don't try to pretend one is the other. But she's also said, you know, at some point, just like any other, you know, leader in the field, any other person who's breaking trail, she says, I have to do what satisfies me, and I can't really worry at the end of the day about whether everybody's going to like it or not. I just, boy, do I admire that.
Well, we have another caller in a moment. Give us a call at 217-333-9455 or send us a message online at will-talk@illinois.edu or on Twitter at Focus580. If you have any questions for Murphy Henry, she's the author of the new book, Pretty Good for a Girl, Women in Bluegrass. And we have a caller on the line. This is Paul from Champaign County. Hey, Paul.
Hi, good morning. Yeah, I live down the block from the Krauses, and I think it should be said that the family was so supportive. Her brother, Victor Krauss, is go-to bass player for people like Bill Laswell and regularly travels with the large band. What is that Texas guy?
Lyle Lovett.
Yeah, Lyle Lovett. And so, but I think there should be something to be said about the supportive community that was here. There was an early community radio station that affirmed bluegrass as a, you know, art form along with the rest of the things when a lot of media were, you know, would had no place for it, and perhaps still do have no place for it. But the Bill Thomas, the station manager, and I think Bill Taylor were both quite supportive of Alison in her younger years. At least that's the way I remember it, and I don't know whether she's reflected on that when you were speaking with her. But I thought I'd get a word in about that sort of aspect of the milieu that she grew up in, and appreciate your work.
Well, thank you, Paul. Thank you for calling in. So, Murphy, an interesting point comes up out of this, which is also just this idea of being surrounded by community, and it does feel like a lot of these people kind of were lucky to grow up in that milieu, but some of them still had to fight their way in a little bit, some of the people you talk about in the book, and it sounds like Alison Krauss had actually a pretty supportive milieu, and it was kind of lucky that way.
Oh, yeah, it sounds like it. And, you know, what Paul said about, you know, the community supporting her and the community radio station supporting the music, I think that is a very important point. And I was trying to think of some other women, you know, who were less supported. I mean, the Stoneman family grew up in a musical family, so their whole family was all about music all the time, and instruments were lying around for them to pick. But you're right. I mean, I think other women, you know, so had less support, you know, from community, and, you know, had to just fight their way through. You're right about that.
You're listening to WYLL. This is Focus, and we're talking about the new book, Pretty Good for a Girl, Women in Bluegrass, with the author, Murphy Henry. I actually wondered, because Alison Krauss really is kind of a singular talent who is kind of like the big bluegrass phenomenon of the last, say, 15 years or whatever. Why do you think she's had so much purchase outside of sort of a core bluegrass audience?
Boy, I guess that is the $64,000 question. You know, Chris, her talent, you know, obviously the incredible support she got from Rounder Records, you know, to sign her. They were a very big independent label. They were, I guess, you know, if you could put in air quotes again, women-friendly label, because they had already done some of the music of Hazel and Alice, You know, so they were women friendly. They supported Allison a whole lot. Allison knew how to surround herself with supportive musicians to get people who could play the kind of music she wanted. But she loved them and their work. So, you know, there was that. And, you know, maybe she just was part of it with just being at the right place, you know, at the right time. She had a banjo player that played with her for a couple of years, Allison Brown, who is now the co-founder of Compass Records in Nashville, a huge independent record label. And Allison's a great banjo player, but Allison said, you know, she felt really lucky to be playing banjo in this era, you know, the 80s, 90s, into the 21st century. She said, and I say this about Allison Krauss also, what if they had had that level of talent back in the early 1900s? You know, where would they have gone with it? So part of it is just being sort of in the right century.
Well, we have a tweet from Lisa in Champaign. She's asking, is Allison Krauss being accepted because she's a fiddle player, not a guitarist? Is that maybe easier for people to accept? The idea being that guitar prowess is sort of more associated with men. And I find that interesting because I actually have a friend in Chicago who is a banjo player, and she went to a banjo camp a couple weeks ago and said that she had fun, but that 90% of the people there were just old men in suspenders in their 90s, and that seemed to be kind of the core constituency for people who played banjo and guitar at this thing.
Right, and you know, you mentioned that my daughter Casey and I do banjo camps, and we sponsor them here in Winchester, and that was our experience going out across the country and finding it was mostly, you know, men. So we're actually sponsoring the first that we know of all female, all women's banjo camp here in Winchester in July, so that we'll just have all women there. But I mean, trying to get back to Lisa's question about you know, Allison being a fiddle player, and is that more acceptable? Maybe so. I mean, maybe so, Lisa. Guitar seems to be one of the last bastions waiting for a whole lot of women to become lead guitar players, because there's still that thought out there in the popular culture that women just aren't strong enough, you know, to do it. You'd kind of have to be familiar with the whole bluegrass jam session arena to understand, you know, we play acoustically, banjos are very loud, fiddles are also loud. If you want to play lead guitar and be heard, you have to be fairly aggressive with it, you know, and you either have to be loud play or have to be comfortable with nobody hearing you, or you have to have strong enough personality to say, could y'all be a little quieter while I'm playing my lead guitar? And even that might set you apart from the guys. It's a tough instrument to develop on and actually be heard even in a jam session.
You're listening to WYLL 580 AM. This is Focus. I'm Chris Berube, and we're speaking with Murphy Henry, the author of the new book, Pretty Good for a Girl, Women in Bluegrass. And if you have any questions for Murphy or thoughts about your own experience playing bluegrass, I know we have quite a few musicians in our audience, give us a call at 217-333-9455, or you can find us online. Send us an email at will-talk@illinois.edu, or you can find us on Facebook and Twitter at Focus580. And we have a few minutes left in the program. Murphy, I do want to talk to you about teaching the banjo, because it's interesting. You are someone who teaches, and you've taught, particularly you have something called the Murphy Method. And I actually want to play a little bit from an instructional video that you made teaching the banjo.
Okay.
So here's something from one of your instructional videos.
Okay.
All right. I know some of you are going to want to play Man of Constant Sorrow in the key of G, so I've come up with a good arrangement. And first of all, we'll play it through fast. Then we'll play it through slow, and then we'll break it down. Here we go. All right, now let's slow it down.
Murphy Henry from one of her videos teaching her method for learning the banjo. And Actually, watching that video, I was just the first time around, I was just so mesmerized by the movement of your fingers and thinking, yeah, I don't know how I would learn to play the banjo. That just seems so far beyond my own ability.
No, I could teach you to do that, Chris. You just start off at the very beginning, and I teach by ear. That's my whole approach to learning to play any of the bluegrass instruments. So we just start off real easy with, you know, you're learning four notes at a time, and then you put four more notes, and it grows. Like, it's a very step-by-step process with all the instruments.
Why do you think the banjo is an instrument that you have to learn orally, that you have to learn by ear?
Well, I think that's true of all the bluegrass instruments because our music is an oral music and it's an improvisational music. So we're constantly being asked in a jam session or even on stage, if you're playing with a pickup band, to perform and take a lead solo on a song that maybe you have never, ever played before. So you have to be able to think on your feet, and you have to have this material in your head, in a place in your brain that you can access and pull it out. And if you learn that stuff by rote or by music notes or by tablature, it's not that accessible.
So when you developed your method, I mean, was that partly because you wanted to teach more women how to learn the banjo?
No, absolutely not. It was because the students that I was teaching, when I was using the paper, we call it our method tablature, they couldn't play. They had no sense of the song. They didn't know what they were playing. They didn't hear the music in it. And then when I started teaching, I was using cassettes at the time. I would play the song for them, and just like you heard, and then I'd break it down into little four-note groups. So all the time, they were hearing what they were doing. And so when they came to putting all the licks together, they had a song. It's kind of amazing, really.
I mean, do you find that young girls and women kind of seek you out, particularly as someone to learn from?
Boy, I wish I could say that was true, Chris, but I don't find that to be the case. Now, I don't know about my DVDs going, you know, that we sell across the country and across the world. Perhaps some people are drawn to them because I'm a woman. That part I don't know, but in all the years I've taught locally, I've still taught way more men than I have taught women.
Now we have an email from a listener. This is from Will in Urbana. Will says, I'm interested in your guest comments about some of the amazing young talent in Newgrass and Americana bands. Specifically, he mentions names like Sarah Jarosh, Brittany Haas, Lauren Rue, Abigail Washburn, Sierra Hull, etc. Do you have any thoughts about, do you feel like we're in a particularly fruitful time for women entering the genre and kind of remaking the genre of bluegrass a little bit?
I do. I really do. But one of the things I found interesting toward the end of my research for this book is how many all-female bands are springing up now again, because I thought they'd kind of died out. I thought they'd had their heyday, served their purpose, which was to get women on stage professionally. And now that women had more doors open to them by being band leaders, I thought we were done. But now all these young women are, for some reason, wanting to play music with each other. Maybe they find it more comfortable. Maybe they like the vocal blend they get, you know, with the three women's voices. But I think we're seeing a lot of that, and I'm really excited about it. And the other thing I have to say I'm excited about with the young people is the mixed gender bands. So we're seeing young people not only with the all-female bands, but we're seeing more young people, it's no big deal to them, you know, to have a couple of men, a couple of women, and they're not related to each other. These are not family bands, but, you know, just people who like to play together. It doesn't seem to make so much difference. So, yeah, I think we're entering a golden era for women in bluegrass.
It's interesting you mentioned that there are more all-women bands cropping up.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that might also be partly because, I mean, as a society, we're at the point now where we are a lot more accepting of women doing more things kind of in the public sphere than we were, say, even 30 years ago?
Yes. Yep. No, I think you hit the nail on the head there, Chris. And yes, I do. And I think that's fortunate, you know, for young women that are coming up, that I really feel maybe they don't quite have as many barriers as those of us who were, you know, the baby boomers and the ones that came before us. It's a little bit easier.
So, Murphy, going back to the book just very quickly, do you kind of see, I mean, you say that the barriers have kind of come down a little bit. I mean, do you still see some barriers today? Do you have people, especially now that you've been writing the book and researching it, do you have people saying things to you like, yeah, there are still obstacles in the way of kind of achieving parity in this genre?
You know, I think, you know, how do I want to say this? That many women that, you know, I talk to about the book or that pick up the book and see the title, Pretty Good for a Girl, they have all still had that experience, you know, of people saying that to them in some way, shape, or form, that you're pretty good for a girl. And as long as that's out there, I think that's a problem. Even though, Chris, I understand that people say it with humor. They think it's funny. But they forget that, you know, it carries this big iceberg, you know, beneath the water of the times when people really meant it, that you were only as good as a girl, which wasn't very good.
Yeah, because actually when I read the title, I felt it was really playful. Like, it didn't seem like it was kind of a hateful title. It kind of sounded like, oh, you're pretty good for a girl. That's usually like a statement of like acceptance of like, you know, welcoming somebody into the band.
Really?
Well, maybe, I mean, like in a joking way, not in like in a serious way. That doesn't strike me. Like, that's a terrible thing to say to somebody, but
right.
It could be kind of, but as you say, it could be said in a joking way, like, oh, you're pretty good for a girl, meaning like, I appreciate your talent and I think that we can play together because you clearly have skills.
I think most women, and I hesitate to speak for most women, nevertheless, I will. I think most women would rather just hear you say, wow, you're pretty good, or wow, you're really good, and just let the good for a girl, because that does seem, to us, or to me, that seems limiting. You know, you're pretty good for a girl, but you're not really pretty good for a guy.
Do you have any advice for young female musicians, for young women trying to get into music?
Oh, I just, you know, develop a thick skin and hang in there. Those two things, you know, surround yourself as far as possible with other female musicians who will be very supportive of you. I find nowadays women to be very supportive of each other. You know, don't hesitate to play with them. Don't hesitate to share stories with them, to, you know, talk with them and just be with them. That's where you're going to find a support network. Although, you know, there are plenty of supportive guys, too. I don't want to take away from them. But I think mainly just hang in there.
Well, Murphy, we're about to wrap up, and I think we're going to end on a track of yours called Eminem Blues. Do you want to give a little introduction to this song before we get to it?
Sure, I'll give you a shorty. This is what I call a blues song from the woman's point of view, because so many blues songs that I listened to when I was in bluegrass were written by men, and they always involved a man getting the blues and hopping a freight train and leaving town. And I always say, it's not that easy for women to leave town. So what do they do when they get the blues? They eat M&Ms.
Murphy Henry, it's been a real delight to have you on the show. Thank you so much for talking to us.
Thank you, Chris.
I'm Jim Meadows, and this hour on Focus, Chris Berube spoke with Murphy Henry. She's a musician and a banjo teacher, and author of the book Pretty Good for a Girl, Women in Bluegrass, published by the University of Illinois Press. Today's show was produced by Lindsay Moon. Jason Croft is our technical director. Tune in for conversations about issues and ideas that affect your life each weekday morning at 10, with a replay at 8 p.m. We welcome any additional comments or questions you have about today's show on our website at will.illinois.edu/focus. You can always find free downloadable podcasts of the show on our website, and you can also find Focus on Facebook and Twitter at Focus580. We'll go out this hour with the title track from Murphy's Eminem Blues.
When a man gets the blues, he hops the first freight train that he meets. When a man gets the blues, he hops the first freight train that he meets. But when a woman gets the blues, Lord, she grabs a bag of M&Ms and eats. She eats the brown ones first, she eats the yellow ones fast, she eats the orange ones next. She saves the red ones until last because she likes to. It makes her feel like she is in control.